Thank you. Right, so today I'm going to be talking about the foundations of quantum field theory. Specifically, I'm going to be interested in a regime between non-relativistic quantum mechanics and relativistic quantum field theory. Because as we go from non-relativistic quantum mechanics to quantum field theory, we have a whole bunch of new phenomena arising. So one of these is, for example, there are obstructions to particle localizability in quantum field theory. And we also have the emergence of vacuum entanglement. So specifically, what I'm going to be interested in is how the impact that special relativity has on giving rise to these features. Because, of course, the common lore is that much of the difference between non-relativistic quantum mechanics and quantum field theory is that in relativistic quantum field theory is that we're introducing special relativity. But as I'm going to show, there's actually sort of more culprits in actually giving rise to this phenomenon. So what we wanted to do was trace exactly the impact special relativity has on this. Of course, eventually, we would like to examine what happens when we start including gravity and start including general relativity in this situation. But for now, we're just looking at the flat space-time case. So this is based on some work I did with a fellow PhD student at Waterloo, Maria Papageorgiou, and it's based on a paper we published a couple months ago. Okay, so of course in quantum field theory is very successful in describing particle physics. It's useful for describing the nature of interactions, it describes creation and relation of particles and so on. But what I'm interested in, what I'm gonna be talking mostly about is the fact that these particle phenomena tend to be localized. So trajectories in sort of cloud chambers, bubble chambers and so on, these trajectories are localized. So both in the transverse direction, but also if you follow these in time, you have the idea that these particles are also localized along the trajectory as well. So what I'm going to look at is the extent to which quantum field theory can describe this aspect of particle physics, describe the fact that particles seem to be localized objects. And so when I talk about what a particle is, for this talk, I'm going to insist that these are entities which are localizable. Of course, there are other considerations. For example, you might want to stipulate that particles are things you can count.
So I guess by localizable, you mean kind of space-time localizable, right?
So I'm going to be talking most about spatial localizability.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, so. But yeah, you'd also want to consider this as well. Right, so particle, I'm going to insist that these are localizable objects. There are other things you could consider or stipulate. So for example, one thing you might want to say is that particles are things you can count. And so you might want some kind of observable number operator, or you may want a Fock space structure for the Hilbert space. You also might want to stipulate that these particles obey the correct relativistic dispersion relation. And there are other things you might want to force as well. But really, I'm going to be thinking about localizability or focusing on localizability. So now the question is, where is a particle? So of course, quantum field theory is based on the premises of locality, based on the structure of locality. It's built in to microcausality conditions for field operators, for example. But particles are represented by states. So if you have a Fock space structure, a single particle state is something that lives in the single particle subspace of the Hilbert space, of the Fock space. But what I want to do is try to find a way to have states describe localizable particles. So the question is, how do we characterize particle localizability in quantum field theory?
So now I'm a bit lost already.
Okay.
So like you said that for you, particles are entities which are localizable.
Yeah.
But then you say that you restrict your attention to particles which are described as states. So are you somehow wedded to interpretation that the entities in quantum field theory are connected with states, or why do you want particles to be described as states?
So, well, I mean, the way we describe, we usually talk about Fock spaces being have this, you know, single particle subspace, two particle subspace, and so on. So I'm saying a single particle is usually represented by a state in the single particle.
Okay.
And so I'm going to talk about localizability, what I mean by that, in a second. So really I'm going to be thinking about like the localizability properties of these states and things like, how do we characterize localizability properties? So maybe it become more clear in the task maybe in the literature. Right, so characterizing localizability of particle localizability in quantum field theory. For example, I'm going to look at some different attempts people have made to try to do this. So I'm going to look at position operators and attempts at building position operators or building local number operators. So the first idea you might have in trying to characterize particle localizability is to cook up a position operator in quantum field theory. So this would be analogous to the situation we have in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, where we have weight functions, which give us probabilities of finding a particle in a certain region of space, or a position operator from which we draw these projection operators to create these probabilities. But it turns out in quantum field theory, we have a no-go theorem called Malamud's theorem. So let me just review what this is about. So in Malamud's theorem, he assumes that we have a Hilbert space, which describes the states of our theory. Also that we have some projection operators associated with spatial regions. So this delta denoted here is corresponds to a spatial region at one fixed time. At every fixed time, we have a bunch of these deltas, and at later times, we also have these deltas. And for each of these, we want a corresponding projection. And we also want a unitary representation of space-time translations. Malamud then makes four assumptions that he wants these projections to satisfy. So the first is translation covariance. So this is how these projection operators interact with the translation group. We also want an energy condition. So this is that the time-like space-time translations are generated by a positive operator. So this is like a positive energy condition. He also postulates we have localizability. So this is if we have two spatial regions on the same time slice, and if they're disjoint, he wants that the projections associated with these two spatial regions are orthogonal to each other. So this is just saying that if we want these projection operators to correspond to asking a question, is there a particle in this region, we can't measure the particle in two different places at the same time. And the fourth assumption is a locality assumption. So this is where we want to introduce special relativity. So this is this assumption is if we have two of these spatial regions which are space-like separated, then the corresponding projection operators should commute with each other. And so this is sort of an analog of the microcausality condition. And so what Malamud finds is that if you just make these four assumptions, then these projections have to be triggered. So we have to be identically zero. And so then he goes on to conclude that, therefore, we have no analog of position operator in quantum field theory if you assume microcausality.
You know, if there is like a robust version of the theorem as well, like can you relax some of these assumptions to be approximate to get like approximate?
So if you, for example, drop four locality, and of course the ordinary position operators of quantum mechanics satisfy the first three. So actually, this fourth assumption, which where you introduce special relativity, is necessary for this. I'm not sure about dropping the other assumptions that's required. So there's some other work that has gotten into the energy condition, like really insisting that this is the important feature here. But I'm not so aware of people looking at dropping some of the other assumptions.
Is it possible to define this operator just within the one-body sector, one particle sector? Not on the whole hyperspace, but on the
space. Yeah, so I'm going to build some stuff later where that would correspond to something like this. So.
Okay.
I think I'll get to this.
Okay. Also, what if HX?
Oh, sorry. So this unitary representation. So this is the translation, the vector you're translating by in flat space.
That is the point of space time or just of space.
So this is like a vector you're translating by in flat space time.
Just a space. There's no time here.
No. There's time here too.
Yeah. Oh.
And so this is when this is time-like. A time-like translation, and this operator that generates the unitary should be positive. So, Yeah.
The third and the fourth item, what's the difference?
So the third one, so I didn't write it out fully, but so the third item is two on the same spatial slice. And this is two in space-time, but space-like separated. So of course, if these two were on the same spatial slice, then this follows from this. Because these are orthogonal. But these don't have to be orthogonal if they're on different spatial slices. They just have to commute with each other. Or sorry, different times, different at different times, that's what I'm saying.
Can't I always do a boost and put everything on the same slice?
Right, so this is, so these statements are in a fixed frame. But you might want to, I'm not postulating any Poincaré transformations or anything like this. We just have translations. But at least, even if you started including Poincaré Lorentz transformations, you'd still want a structure like this.
So is that a coordination 2 in a space time of limit 1?
1.
The delta region is dimension 2 of limitation 1.
So if you have a space time at one fixed time on a spatial slice, you take some region of the spatial slice. Yeah.
Related to the Riesz-Dieter theorem?
Yeah, so that's my next slide.
And can you just give a simple explanation as to why this, what the proof is? Is it because when you apply this time translation, that space like different time regions end up overlapping? What is there some simple explanation?
Yeah, it's something like that. Actually, it's been a while since I read this proof.
Okay.
So I think it's something like that. He translates things around, he brings it back, and then
okay.
Shows that they have to, if they overlap, they have to be zero.
Like if it spreads too quickly, then it's going to.
Yeah. And there's been some other work showing that this energy condition actually causes things to spread too quickly. Okay, so I'm going to move on. So this theorem says that we can't have position operators, reasonable notion of position operator in quantum field theory. We don't have position operators, but maybe we can cook up some notion of a local number operator. So some sort of operator where we can ask, okay, in this region of space, how many particles are there? And so if you had some finite volume V, you would want to cook up a set of creation annihilation operators, create a local number operator, and count locally. But it turns out there's a no-go theorem for this as well. It's the Riesz-Dieter theorem, or it's actually a corollary to the Riesz-Dieter theorem. So this theorem is formulated in the context of algebraic quantum field theory. So remember, in algebraic quantum field theory, we have algebras associated to every open region of space-time. So for example, in simple situations, you can think of this as being generated by smeared field operators, these local algebras, where these Fs have compact support in these open regions. And the corollary to the Riesz-Dieter theorem that prohibits local number operators, the statement of it is the following. So if we have an element in one of these local algebras and annihilates the global vacuum, so here the global vacuum is the unique Poincaré invariant state in the Hilbert space, then this operator has to be identically zero. So what this means is that we can't have some notion of annihilation operator that annihilates the global vacuum in one of these local regions. It means that if we want some sort of Fox space structure, some sort of Fox space structure, which would indicate that the global vacuum has zero particles, then these annihilation operators have to be identically zero, which means that we can't actually construct such a Fox space. Okay, so these are two abstract. Yeah.
So these are we draw in the free theory.
No.
But in free theory, we can do that.
No, I'll talk about this. Yeah. So it's a good question. So these are two abstract results which say that we can't have any nice notions of position operators, local number operators in quantum field theory. which would indicate that we can't have a good notion of describing localizable particles by some states in the theory.
Okay, so yeah. A of O contains only the bounded operators anyway, right? And you wouldn't, presumably wouldn't expect the number of right operators.
No, you can build a few of these with unbounded operators.
And then you get the same statement.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I think so. I haven't thought too much about that. That's a good question. But yeah, indeed, you can. I don't think there's an assumption that goes into the Riesz-Leder theorem about boundedness, but I'll have to look that up. So for example, you can build, in a free theory, you can build these algebras with smeared field operators. Of course, these aren't bounded operators. Yet the whole structure goes through.
One basic set of IQTs with these algebras are phenomenal.
That's a common construction, but there are people who have built models of this with unbounded operators.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, right. So these are abstract results which would suggest that there's a limitation to the extent that quantum field theory can describe localizable particles. But what we wanted to do was try it anyway. We wanted to build some concrete scenarios where we said, okay, well, maybe there's some way I can cook up some way. I think I can cook up a local number operator in quantum field theory, and then we wanted to see, okay, where does this break? Where do these obstructions come in? Where do these limitations, the Riesz-Leder theorem and Malamud theorem, how do these come in to prevent us from actually building these things? And so, what we looked at were a couple of schemes to attempt localization, and we considered a simple example of a free Klein-Gordon field. So the first scheme we had is based on the ordinary creation-annihilation operators that we build in free quantum field theory. So the A's and A daggers that diagonalize the Hamiltonian and create these momentum states. So these are the ones we'd have in particle physics. And then we can take these momentum-based creation-annihilation operators and do a Fourier transform. And then we can use these to create things that look like wave packet states. So this AX dagger acting on the global vacuum, you can think of that sort of analogous to an X eigenvector in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And then you might want to think of this psi of X as kind of like an analog in QFT of a wave function. And so the idea would be that maybe this wave packet actually characterizes the localizability of these particles in space. So for example, if this wave packet had compact support in space, we could say, okay, there's definitely one particle in this region of space. So this is the first scheme, and this is sort of a scheme we use in particle physics for localizing, talking about localized particles. So are there any alternative schemes? So the other one we looked at was based on the idea that the Klein-Gordon equation is a set of local coupled harmonic oscillators. So the way to think about this is if we dropped the Laplacian term, the spatial derivative term, the Klein-Gordon equation, and take the mass term to the other side, then we have that the second time derivative of the field at every point is just directly proportional to its amplitude at every point, which means that at every point in space, we have a harmonic oscillator, an ordinary quantum mechanical harmonic oscillator. And so these oscillators, at every point, we can build a Fock space for these, like we do in ordinary quantum mechanics. So we can generate a Fock space using sort of these B of X's, which are I'm going to be calling our local creation annihilation operators, because these are the ones that are directly written in terms of the field amplitudes, so the phi of X and the pi of X at every point in space. But now, this is motivated by the idea that the Klein-Gordon equation's harmonic oscillators when we drop the Laplacian. But of course, we want to put it back in there because we want to describe the whole Klein-Gordon theory. So when you put it back in there, what this does is actually couples these local oscillators. And so you can see that, for example, in the Hamiltonian written in terms of these B's and B daggers. So this derivative couple these local oscillators. In a simpler scenario, you can see this if you discretize the Klein-Gordon equation, then you can think of a derivative as just coupling the local oscillators on a discrete lattice. Sorry. And then it turns into derivative in a continuum limit. Now, crucially, that looking at the Klein-Gordon equation this way, it tells us or it gives us the intuition that the vacuum ends up being entangled. Because when we talk about vacuum entanglement in quantum field theory, we're talking about the entanglement between spatial degrees of freedom in space. And so when we talk about entanglement, what we're really appealing to is this idea that at every point in space, we have these harmonic oscillators, and they're just coupled by the spatial derivative term. And the spatial derivative term, the coupling, eventually gives us the fact that the vacuum is entangled. And so I'm going to be talking about entanglement later. So that idea will be important, that these B's and B daggers really characterize the degrees of freedom in the field theory, which are entangled. Okay, so that's the second scheme we have to attempt localizability. So now the question is, we have these A's and A daggers, which are the Fourier transform of the usual momentum ones. And we also have these local ones, which are the B's and B daggers written in terms of the field operators characterizing these local oscillators. But now the question is, okay, well, we have this no-go theorem saying we can't have local number operators, yet we've constructed two operators which look like number operators, at least superficially. So how do these number operators actually run up against the Riesz-Schlieder theorem? So what breaks down here in these two schemes? So the first scheme...
Can you go back one second? No. Just a quick question. So are you smearing, do you weigh A dagger and A over some function, or because this is just calculates no local operator. This just calculates, or it's X only run over some.
Oh, I see. So you mean have some limits?
Yeah, I mean if you just integrate over X, that's not a local number operator.
Sure, that's the total
number operator of your whole system.
Right. So that's a good point. Yeah. So maybe more analogous to the way I wrote it before, you might want to have a V here, saying restricting to some region of space. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, that's a good point. Okay, so how do these two schemes run up against the Riesz-Schlieder theorem? Well, so the first set, the ones that are Fourier transformed to the usual momentum space creation annihilation operators. So you can see that actually these operators are acting non-locally in space. And the way you see that is by writing this, how they're related to the B's and B daggers, which of course are characterizing the local oscillators in space. And what you find is that they're related to the spatial, the local ones, with these two integral kernels, which decay exponentially with the Compton scale. So actually what these A's are doing that we're using to create these wave packet states, they're actually acting everywhere in space. So they decay exponentially, but they do act everywhere. And so these wave packets we constructed actually don't characterize localizability in space, but they're sort of up to this non-local exponential decay. So these wave packets are actually non-local, despite their superficial appearance. So the second set of creation annihilation operators, these local ones, well, we can use the same Bogoliubov transformation to see that these are also inappropriate for counting particles. So the simplest thing to see is that the annihilation operator, the A annihilation operator, has a beta coefficient or a component which is proportional to the creation operator of these local oscillators. And so you can use that to argue that these local annihilation operators actually don't annihilate the global vacuum, which means that they wouldn't consider the global vacuum as a zero particle state. So actually these B's and B daggers are counting different notions of particle. So actually so the number operator you construct using these are counting different things. Furthermore, actually these two Fock spaces are unitarily inequivalent. So remember in quantum field theory, we don't have an analog of the Stone von Neumann theorem because we have an infinite number of harmonic oscillators or an infinite number of degrees of freedom. And so you can't guarantee that there are all the representations of the canonical commutation relations will be unitarily equivalent. And in fact, this is an example where we have unitary inequivalence between two different representations. And so not only are these two Fock spaces counting different notions of particle, but actually you can't even compare the two notions of particle in these two cases. Yeah.
That's a very nice. So, I agree that those are like different unitary representations, but on the slide before, you used this somehow to argue that your Bs don't truly like annihilate localized particles. So how do you make this argument if you're like actually two completely different representations, right? Like the notion of particle should probably be tied to a singular representation.
Okay, so is your problem the fact that I'm trying to act this on here?
No, I'm fine that it doesn't annihilate it. I'm just wondering how you sort of like in the previous slide made the argument that just by the fact that they're like non-unitarily related and describe different, like have different background, those constructions, how this sort of like leads you to conclude that AY does not annihilate like localized particles because you like have two completely different representations of annihilation and creation operators that you compare.
Well, in this case, I was really just wanted to emphasize the fact that these have some are non-local in space because of these integral kernels. Because the Bs and B daggers are just directly related in terms of the field operators. And it's the field operators in field theory that really we want to think about as corresponding to points in space. So like 5x is really 5.x, right? So I don't know, maybe we can talk about that later. Yeah, I agree. It's a bit of a tricky issue to distill a lot of these things. Yeah. Okay. So just to summarize, so we have the first attempt at localization, which is built using these Fourier transforms of the usual creation annihilation operators. But the way this runs up against the Riesz-Schlatter theorem is that they end up being non-local in space, so non-locally related to the field operators. Other set, the local oscillators, the local creation annihilation operators, they do, I would say, label degrees of freedom in space, but they have other problems, like they're not preserved in time, and they don't obey the correct dispersion relation, they don't annihilate the global vacuum, and so on, the ordinary sets of creation annihilation operators do have these nice properties. So, what we were interested in looking at...
Are you expected to be preserved in time, given that particles disperse?
Sorry?
Given that particles disperse over time, why would you expect the number operator to commute with the Hamiltonian? Why would you expect a notion of local number operator to be preserved in time, given that particles will physically disperse?
You want, at least if you integrate over all space, you'd like that to be preserved.
Okay,
So it's but yeah, if you integrate it over all space, you want that to be preserved in time, and it's not for the case of those Bs. Yes. Okay, thanks. So in a relativistic quantum field theory, we have these problems limitations to the extent to which quantum field theory can describe localizable particles. But now we also observe that these operators, the A's and A daggers, have this exponential decay of their non-locality with the Compton scale. So what we were interested in looking at was, okay, if we were above the Compton scale, I suppose we start entering the regime of quantum mechanics, maybe we get some sort of effective approximate notion of localizable particle. So that's the next thing we looked at was, okay, in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, we have good notions of position operators and local number operators. In relativistic quantum field theory, we don't. So where is it along the way that the obstruction comes along? So is it just the impact of special relativity, introducing special relativity to get relativistic quantum field theory that provides this obstruction, or is it something else along the way going to non-relativistic quantum mechanics that causes these problems? So concretely, what we wanted to look at was whether the tension between these two schemes is actually resolved. So maybe these schemes actually match after you take the non-relativistic limit. And after doing that, maybe you recover the ordinary notions of position operator, local number operator, and quantum mechanics. Okay, so the first thing, how do we take this non-relativistic approximation? Well, what we want to do, of course, is approximate these particles in the regime where the velocities are slow compared to the speed of light. And this just translates directly into the wave numbers of these particles being much less than the confidence scale. And so this is just a simple exercise of introducing scales, mass, and h bar. And then for technical convenience, what we're going to do is introduce a cutoff on a hard cutoff on the wave numbers, and then expand everything to second order in this cutoff over the Compton scale. And so to second order because the wave numbers over the Compton scale, we're expanding the wave numbers over the Compton scale to second order because we want the momentum compared to the mass to expand to second order, so we recover the proper kinetic term in the Schrodinger equation, for example. So then we want to ask the question, does this Bogoliubov transformation somehow become the identity in this limit? So the idea being, okay, above this Compton scale, above this exponential decay of these kernels, do these integral kernels sort of become the identity, and do we lose the beta coefficient that provides the obstruction to comparing the two notions of particles? Turns out that that's not the case. Although one of the integral kernels actually does become the identity operator, the one comparing the annihilation operators of the two schemes, we get a remnant of the beta coefficient, so the one comparing, the one relating the annihilation operator of one scheme and the creation operator of the other. Actually, this persists in the non-relativistic limit, and so we get this remnant, and it's at second order in our expansion. So we get this remnant of this non-locality after the non-relativistic approximation. And so we also show that these two Fock spaces also remain unitarily inequivalent after this approximation. So what this means is that actually just taking away the special relativistic features of field theory, we don't recover the notions of particle localizability we would expect to have in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So that means there's some other culprit hiding in this story. There's more to this story than just taking away special relativity. So first, this would raise a bunch of questions about, okay, so how do we actually recover quantum mechanics then? If it's not just a non-relativistic limit, where is quantum mechanics hiding in this? And so we found that the only sensible way of reconstructing quantum mechanics in this limit is using these Fourier transformed operators, these A's and A daggers, which were just the Fourier transforms, the usual momentum space creation annihilation operators. And so for these, you can construct wave functions. So things, after you fix number of particles, you look at the coefficients in one of these subspaces, and these coefficients obey the Schrodinger equation. And we can also recover position operator using these, which has a sensible notion in terms of these, and also obeys the Heisenberg algebra with the total momentum operator. Now, of course, so formally this looks like quantum mechanics, of course, but the fact is that these y's, these inputs to the wave functions, are still these sort of non-local objects. So they're a non-local characterization of space, or these A daggers are creating particles, but are still related to space non-locally. And so we still have this sort of gap between these two schemes because we have these, in quantum field theory, the local creation annihilation operators, which are really labeling spatial degrees of freedom. And we have the A's and A daggers that are useful for describing quantum mechanics. But we at least expected these to coincide in the non-relativistic limit. And of course, and we found they don't. But we also found that this had been considered before. So I found in Dworkin and Drell's book on relativistic quantum mechanics that when they were taking the non-relativistic limit of the Schrodinger of the Klein-Gordon equation, to recover the Schrodinger equation, they needed to do what they called a Foldy-Wuthusen transformation, where they were talking about how, okay, we have to apply unitary to decouple the evolution of the positive and negative frequencies in order to recover particles in the non-relativistic limit, or sensible notions of particles in the non-relativistic limit. And then I showed that what they were doing in their book is actually equivalent to this Bogoliubov transformation we had been playing with between these local creation annihilation operators and the standard ones, which are the Fourier transformed ones. But of course, this transformation isn't actually unitary because our two Fock spaces are unitarily equivalent. But important for our purposes was that this transformation actually involves a non-local reshuffling of the degrees of freedom of field theory in order to recover our notions of particle and non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Okay. So just to recap, we had these obstructions to particle localizability given by Malamud's theorem and the Riesch-Leder theorem. And we found that these obstructions don't actually subside when we take the non-relativistic approximation. So just special relativity, taking away the special relativistic features of the field theory, we don't recover particle localizability. There's more to the story than that. But of course, so Malamud theorem and Riesch-Leder theorem are sort of some old theorems, and particle localizability is an old question in quantum field theory. So we also wanted to look forward and extend this to and connect to sort of some more modern topics. So one thing we looked at was how this relates to entanglement. So it turns out that entanglement is related to particle localizability. So the idea, the intuition is that entanglement gives the vacuum a fundamentally non-local character, because I said this, we have this coupling between the local oscillators and the quantum field theory, and so the vacuum is entangled. And so we have this idea that maybe this is also, this non-locality induced by the entanglement is obstructing particle localizability. So then it's a natural question in this case to look at that, but also look at what happens to entanglement in field theory in the non-relativistic limit. Of course, entanglement's also of independent interest for all sorts of reasons, like in Hunter-Hawking effects and in holography and condensed matter and quantum information and so on. But what we wanted to look at was how entanglement is an important feature in this, in these sort of foundational questions in quantum field theory. So why would entanglement be related to localizability? So remember this corollary I'd been talking about that obstructed local number operators, which is that if we have an element in these local algebras and it annihilates the global vacuum, then it's identically zero. And this means that we can't have a good notion of annihilation operator that annihilates the global vacuum. So this is a corollary to the Riesch-Leder theorem, but I wanted to look at, remind you of the Riesch-Leder theorem itself. And so what this says is that for any open region of space-time, the global vacuum is cyclic for these local algebras. So what that means is that by choosing an appropriate operator in these local algebras and acting it on the vacuum, I can approximate any state in the whole Hilbert space. So, I mean, this is much discussed in Foundations of Quantum Field Theory. But it turns out that it's actually related to vacuum entanglement, or there's an idea that it could be related to vacuum entanglement. So this is some intuition by Michael Redhead in a paper in 95, giving the intuition that the reason for the Riesch-Leder theorem for this non-locality is that the vacuum's entangled. And what he showed was that you can actually reproduce an analogous situation just with two qubits. And so he proved something called the baby Riesch-Leder theorem, which is that if you take a Bell state, then it's cyclic for the operators acting on the first qubit. So what that means is you can create any state in the whole Hilbert space just by acting on the first qubit. This is actually pretty easy to see if you write it out like I have here.
So acting on the first qubit, I have a linear combination of poly operators. And of course, so these poly operators acting on the first qubit, we can generate all of the Bell states just by acting on this Bell state. And if I am allowed to add arbitrary linear combinations of these things, then I can create any state in the entire Hilbert space. Now, of course, this isn't unitary. We can't just add unitaries. But that's not the statement of the Riesch-Leder theorem. In the Riesch-Leder theorem, it allows us to just take any element in these local algebras. So they don't necessarily have to be operations. But what Redhead's point was is that you should only be able to do this if you have a max Reink entangled state. And so in this case, of course, if we were trying to do this with a separable state by acting just on the first qubit, we can only create separable states. So the reason we can do this, to create any state in the whole Hilbert space, is because the state you're acting on is entangled, and it actually is max Reink entangled. So this is the idea that, okay, so the cyclicity property, which eventually gives rise to the obstruction of the local number operators, is actually related to the fact that the vacuum is entangled. So in looking at how particle localizability, or the limitations for particle localizability in quantum field theory in the non-relativistic limit, it's natural to ask, okay, what is entanglement? Does entanglement also disappear if we take the non-relativistic limit of quantum field theory? Because if it did, then there's something else going on with particle localizability, and there would be something wrong with Redhead's intuition here. So we can actually test this intuition by taking the limit and looking at entanglement in this situation as well. Okay, so remember when I was talking about entanglement, it had to do, the intuition behind entanglement in field theory was between the local degrees of freedom, these local oscillators of the field, which are then coupled through the spatial derivative term. And so when we're talking about entanglement in quantum field theory, we're talking about entanglement between these degrees of freedom. Now, because we've introduced a cutoff, actually the story behind local degrees of freedom becomes more complicated. And actually, by introducing cutoff, we get what's called a sampling theory. And so sampling theory is a way to describe fields as discretized on space. But it turns out it's not just a lattice theory. It's more subtle than that. We actually can represent these fields on any lattice as long as the lattice spacing is small enough. So it's more subtle than just a lattice theory, but for my purposes here, I just need the fact that these fields, after introducing the cutoff, we can represent them on the lattice, and the local degrees of freedom of the field after introducing the cutoff is just the field amplitudes at these lattice points. And so there's much more that can be said about sampling theory, and I'm actually giving a talk in the quantum gravity seminar on Thursday about this, because I've written a few papers about this. But for now, I just need these two basic facts. And that, so looking at entanglement between degrees of freedom, local degrees of freedom, and this limit is just looking at entanglement between these local oscillators. And so we can characterize entanglement by looking at how the global vacuum, after we introduce this cutoff, looks like in terms of local degrees of freedom. So we can do this explicitly by looking at this Bogoliubov transformation. And so if you write out what this global ground state looks like in terms of these local degrees of freedom, we find that's a superposition of zero of the local vacuum and two single particle excitations and a two particle excitation. And if you play around with this, with the actual alpha and beta operators we had in this case, we find that it is indeed still an entangled state. But of course, there's some subtleties going on here because this map doesn't really exist because these Fock spaces are unitarily inequivalent. So to be more careful, we actually looked at some concrete measures of entanglement. So one thing we looked at was sort of analogous to the Unruh effect, that if we take one of these local oscillators and trace out the rest, we can ask, is this oscillator in a thermal state? So this is sort of analogous to the case where you calculate temperature for two Rindler wedges in the Unruh effect. And we found that actually one of these oscillators is still, one of these single oscillators, it does still have a non-zero temperature in the non-relativistic regime. So that indicates that it's entangled with the rest of the the rest of the field. But a more sort of traditional entanglement measure we calculated was logarithmic negativity between two of these local oscillators. And so, for example, you can calculate in one dimension between two lattice points that are arm spacings apart. It's second order in this cutoff over the Compton scale parameter that we were expanding in. So indeed, entanglement is still persists in the non-relativistic limit of field theory. Okay, just to summarize. So we started by looking at the obstructions that quantum field theory, the obstructions and the extent to which quantum field theory can describe localizable particles. So this was Malan's theorem and Riesz-Schlatter theorem. And we found that these obstructions actually persist when we take the non-relativistic approximation of quantum field theory. And also these obstructions are related to vacuum entanglement through the Riesz-Schlatter theorem and Redhead's intuition. And this is consistent with these other findings because this also persists in this regime. So that's all I have. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much for that. I have just one question.
Yep.
And how does your work relate with the Newman and Rigney's construction of localizable space?
Right. So that's another localization scheme, which is similar to the Fourier transform ones. So I think in that scheme, they also introduce another measure factor in momentum space. But it's related to that. It's closely related to that one. It has the same non-locality problems that one has, that they're actually this position operator is actually acting, or the creation annihilation operators you'd get from that are acting non-locally in space. Yeah, so it's very closely related, for sure.
Right, so what do you have to say about constructing like a photon-wave function in position orientation?
Well, I mean, there are lots of known issues with these particle states have propagate superluminally. It's sort of very similar to this these Fourier transformed operators we're looking at, because these also have those kind of problems too.
So then you would say that issue of non-localizability in terms of constructing a photon wave in the position orientation is not even unique to photons, like you brought by any relativistic.
Yeah. And here we're talking about massive fields, because it doesn't really make sense to take a non-relativistic limit of light. Or it's like easier in this case, for sure. Yeah. Thanks.
What happens to the notion of space-like in the Malman theorem when you take your limit to non-relativistic? Does that notion still exist? Because you're saying that there's some remnant, this theorem still poses a problem. The notion of space-like is doesn't survive.
I think, because when we take this limit, everything's going to propagate superluminally.
Well, the question is whether these theorems are the reason for the obstruction continues.
No, I think it's really, like, in what we looked at is really more about the Riesz-Schlatter theorem and its relationship to entanglement. So I think it's still just the Riesz-Schlatter theorem that's causing the problems.
Okay.
Yeah. Because we know, of course, if you drop this locality assumption out, then that's, we can extract. It's just not the same ones that we can.
And so how we go about generalizing your results in Kev space time, for
example? That's a good question. Well, I mean, in curved space time, there's, of course, all sorts of other problems coming in. So for example, there's not a unique vacuum state. There's not a preferred vacuum state to pick. But also generically on a curved space-time, you have unitarily equivalence when you have a dynamic background. So like even if you had a good notion of particle at one time, later it's not going to be a good notion of particle. There's all sorts of issues like this coming in here. But so here we showed, we have the fact that it's even a problem in special relativity. So, and of course, if you want to do quantum gravity, you have problems of different Markovitz invariants and observables and things like this that you have to take into account. Yeah. Anyway, there's all sorts of other things you have to consider for sure.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Well, if not, let's thank Jason again. Thank you.
Thank you.